From your boy Deshaun Foster, I'd like to give UCLA B team a shout out. Hope you guys keep up the good work.
Welcome back to the B Team, the internet's number two UCLA sports podcast. I am Nathan Eberhardt. With me tonight is Michael Hanna. Hanna, the last time we recorded an episode was December 6th. Has anything changed in the world since then?
The more things change, the more they stay the same in many regards. At that point, we were planning to discuss the UCLA North Carolina game. I think we were going to talk about UCLA.
North Carolina basketball. Yep.
Basketball. You're referring to the bowl. Yeah, we were going to do a bowl game breakdown. That didn't end up happening. I ended up not being able to podcast that next week because there was no North Carolina game to recap, and I just got bogged down in work before having to go on vacation. I say having to go as if it was some sort of chore after going on vacation for the holidays. And so I finally came back, and while I was gone, we didn't play in a bowl game. Chip Kelly, there was no movement on his contract, and things were just kind of in limbo. And then since I've been back, the UCLA basketball team has gone back to playing games and lost one recently, and Chip was extended for the sake of extending him. Jerry Azenauer apparently retired. The transfer portal went berserk. Johnny Nansen left the coaching staff to become a defensive coordinator. UCLA's entire coaching staff is basically turned over at this point, minus I think Deshaun Foster might be the only holdover besides Don Pelham from the original staff.
Only one worth holding on to.
Naturally. So between...
Is Jerry Neuheisel still there?
He is, but he was a grad assistant at first.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about like the Chip OGs, as it
the original coaching staff. Got it.
Yeah. So it's just massive upheaval on the football side. All the things have stayed the same with Chip being there. Everything else is changing around him, and the basketball team, Mick Cronin, is not happy with the way things are going right now. So I mean, there's a lot of meat on the bone for us right now, more than we would have had in mid December. That's for sure. How's everything going with you?
Going well, ready to re-engage with UCLA sports, if UCLA sports is ready to re-engage with the world.
I'm not sure it is, but they're going to have to do it anyway, unfortunately.
Ready, not necessarily ready and able.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's what we're going to do. We asked, we put out a call for questions last week in anticipation of tonight's kind of catch back up show. And so what we're going to let you, Hanna, take the reins and throw the questions to me, not as some sort of expert, but just to kind of, you know, you're the one who's seen them and I haven't yet, so it'll be kind of fun. But I am going to use host's prerogative and throw out my own question first. Tell me about the loss to Oregon in basketball. I know that was one of the ones we circled at the beginning of the year as a bellwether. And, you know, so what does it mean? Should we be concerned? Is it just part of the expected growth pattern of this team? Does it adjust our expectations for, you know, what the team is and isn't based on, you know, what we thought coming into the season? You know, tell me what I should think about the fact that we got our second loss of the year, this time to Oregon.
It's hard to know, quite frankly, because I mean, in one sense, you can kind of track it to the pattern we've had under Cronin, where they have not a midseason lull necessarily, but it's not really a team that's kicked into high gear until like late February, March-ish. In his first year, they had that run from late January. So I guess middle of the Pac-12 schedule on is when they really start to find their feet. Even last year when they were losing four straight, it wasn't a team that you felt was out of any game. And quite frankly, they played a lot of closer games than you would have expected against teams that were outclassing them for a lot of the season. And it was just in games where they were favored that they didn't really... They didn't run them off the floor. They played to the level of their competition at that time, but that was a step ahead of where they were just kind of muddling around for so long before that. Obviously, we had no indication that a Final Four run was coming, losing four straight to wrap up the season, but those were not games where they necessarily embarrassed themselves, minus the Oregon State game, which we found out was no embarrassment later on when they made the Elite Eight themselves. So it's hard to say just based on the way that Cronin teams have tracked since Mick has been here, but also because they had something just so unique happen this season, basically taking an entire month off and coming back and not having fans on top of that. So it's a unique and unprecedented time for any college basketball team. I don't know a single college. Now, obviously, it's not unique to UCLA this season, but this might even be weirder than last year when we got used to having no fans and everyone kind of on the same playing field. This year, there's so much upheaval in terms of different conferences, different schools following different standards, and the level of cancellations, the rate of cancellations is so much higher right now. And last year, I don't remember that there were that many Pac-12 games canceled. I mean, they were playing them all behind closed doors. The students were at home, basically. The players were bubbled, essentially. So, I mean, this is almost playing out like the way people feared last year would play out. And so it's been strange. And I don't know that you can really attribute this, or I don't know if you can pin down any one thing that this Oregon game was about. To me, the one thing that truly stood out for it was the passivity, really, of Jaime Jaquez. But that guy has been so beaten up this season. I feel like he gets like a new injury every game he plays, that I don't know if you can chalk that up to him being passive or unhealthy or whatever it happens to be. He just was not in the flow of the offense that game. Tiger Campbell hit a few key threes, excuse me. Johnny Juzang had, I think he got over 20 points in that game, but Jules Bernard did not have it on offense besides that. Jaime Jaquez did not have it on offense. Jalen Clark made some key plays, obviously, to get UCLA into overtime to begin with. If you think of this as a team of like kind of four core players with a very nice supporting cast around them, of that core four, two of them really did not show up against Oregon. And against a team like that, who is undeniably on an upswing right now, because they came back, they went to Galen Center 2 days later and they just absolutely smacked USC around. They didn't, in a way that they really didn't smack UCLA around, but they smacked USC around 2 days later. So against a team like that, I'm not saying that everybody has to be clicking on all cylinders for UCLA to have a chance, but having two players who are basically totally out of it as far as their usual level of quality, that's something that's hard to overcome. So I don't know what you would attribute it to. I just know that Mick Cronin's not happy about the fact that there are no fans. He consistently points to the fact that the Lakers and the Rams have full arenas and full stadiums, but UCLA doesn't. USC doesn't, for that matter, nor does Stanford. But I think those are the only three in the Pac-12, and I want to say the country right now, that are refusing to have any sort of fan, refusing to put any fans in their arena right now. And it's wearing on him, and the players are on social media when they, like, I've noticed posts where they talk about that and they'll come out and say, yep, coach got her back, coach is right, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to be something that the team is pushing back against the school administration about.
And it is a school administration decision, right? That's not a state or UC regents, or
it's not a county thing
made at the UCLA administration level.
It is, because I mean, it's not a UC region thing. We know that because Berkeley has fans right now, but although they might be just naturally socially distancing because they're awful at basketball, I don't know of any restrictions. Although I haven't looked into it, being completely honest, I don't know of any restrictions at like UCI or UC Riverside or UCSB or something like that. As far as I know, on the Pac-12 level, UCLA, USC, and Stanford are going it alone, and the rest of the conferences, the major conferences in this country, are not going to be oriented in a way to be inclined to leave fans out. I'll word it in that way. So yeah, UCLA is going through something particularly unique right now. They set a target date for fans to return of this Friday, the 21st. That's a date that looms particularly large because they have Arizona at Pauley next Tuesday. And that is a game where you do want fan support, given that Arizona has been a good team this year. We'll see about top five in the country, but they've been a good team this year. So you'd have to imagine UCLA's players are going to bring it, especially given the sniping that has gone on between the various fan bases since the cancellation of the original Arizona date. and the conspiracy theories put out by certain Arizona-oriented idiots on the internet that UCLA was ducking Arizona and the Pac-12 was helping them as their favored child. And yeah, the Pac-12 does favor us because we're actually a blue blood and Arizona is a truck stop. So yeah, take that, Arizona. Screw you. Even if it is true, I almost want it to be true because Arizona fans are contemptible people. So, or a lot of Arizona basketball fans are contemptible people. So regardless, that is a game that's going to be particularly heated amongst the players. So to have a passionate group of fans there, the way that there were during the Villanova game, which in many ways helped carry the team that day. I felt like, I mean, the energy was real and the players were into it. I think that would be huge next Tuesday. We'll see whether they have fans, the percentage of fans they allow in, and whether it's something that the team feeds off of or gets frustrated by, depending on the amount of people in the building that day. They'll be up for it because it's a game against Arizona, and that is the basketball rivalry game between big brother and little brother. But will it really, I mean, that game and decisions that are made surrounding that game will be key in determining a lot of things about this season. And I think that's the best way I can put it right now.
Okay. I know I told you to take the reins, but I do want to, since we're on the topic.
Yeah. You happen to be an equal host on the show.
Well, I know, but I set up a conceit for what the episode was going to be like, and I'm undermining it right away.
No. Go crazy, bud. The people are here to listen to what you got to say. Go for it.
Well, I don't have anything to say. I have a question, which is, while we are on the topic, do you have any thoughts about the, what do you want to say, the arguments and discussion and the press that UCLA got after the cancellation of the Holiday Bowl? I mean, I'll throw out my read on it is that, right, that it's not so much that UCLA decided not to play, but rather that they were incommunicative with either the bowl, the bowl officials, the opponents, or our own fans when they knew or had an inkling prior that this was going to, likely happen, that they were going to have to pull out of the game. And did not share that, for whatever reason, presumably, Chip's obsession with, needless secrecy, and or just his reluctance to talk to other human beings. But
I would have put that in Chip's court, but go on.
Okay, so that's my question is that an accurate read on the situation? And I am not terribly inclined to go to bat, for UCLA in a my team right or wrong on this one, as I would be sometimes, just because from what little I know, it does seem like, while making the call not to play certainly seems logical and the only call you can make given who was and wasn't available, it does sound to me like that there were communication issues, but tell me if I'm wrong.
There were definitely communication issues. I tend to believe that, from what I know about it, having followed it from afar and with spotty internet connection, and kind of, ascertaining or kind of putting the pieces together afterwards, I do get the sense that UCLA was the party in the wrong, but I also think NC State ran with that and cast themselves as some sort of martyr. They gave themselves a martyr or victim, role that was completely undeserved, because at the end of the day, an exhibition football game was canceled on them. I whooped it. You had to travel from the East Coast to San Diego during the winter. I'm just, my heart bleeds for you.
I mean, I think to me, the most telling thing is the fact that Dave Dorn was going to get a bonus for having won an additional game. And so him being that vocal about not getting to play that game tells me everything about what his priority really was and what he is actually angry about.
Dave Doran is he's an insufferable douchebag, and it's been known for a very long time. So, okay, cool. Sorry about your six-figure bonus when you're already making, 40 times that as your salary? My heart bleeds for you, Dave Doran, you piece of shit. Anyway, was that subtle enough? I'm just going to point this out. It has seemed to be a theme for UCLA really since the beginning of this academic year that crisis communication or communication regarding potentially negative events has been spotty. For example, the Villanova game, the issue getting the fans in where you probably didn't have the lines were so long that people waited 2 to 2.5 hours to get into Pauley Pavilion for the biggest non-conference game on campus of the season. You only have two lines for checking COVID vaccination cards when you're hosting a crowd of over 10,000 people. Like, and then no communication regarding the fact that that's the way it was going to go. No pre-planning for the fact that this might not be the best way to do things. The plane issue on the way to Marquette and the rescheduling of that game, UCLA really didn't put out any communication at all with regards to that. The Holiday Bowl, that was a last second cancellation. The Oregon game, people not finding out that there would be no fans until the day of the game. Like, it is a consistent running theme right now with UCLA's SID and athletic department that they are not communicating events that can be taken in a negative manner until the absolute last possible moment. And it is it's a serious problem, and it's pissing off a lot of people, partners and people at UCLA alike.
The interesting thing about it is that, you know, we had identified one of the strengths of Jarman had been his communication. Now, obviously, communication in terms of positive messaging and engaging, you know, fans to get, you know, interest or to build interest in the product is a different thing from crisis communication. I recognize that, but it surprises me that that would be what marks, his administration in the athletic department right now, given, where we had given him such high marks prior.
If you think about it, the high marks that came prior, one was a kind of the football season last year was a bit of, they played seven games. It was a bit of a non-event. There wasn't really much on the table there besides, getting rid of Chip Kelly for having a terrible record. But besides the point, the basketball team made a Final Four run. Football team started out the season well enough that they got College Game Day. They had the big win against LSU. When you're riding high, you can put out the positive messages. But when you have to get down in the trenches and get your hands dirty in that regard, there seems to be a running. I'm not sure whether it's Jarman or whoever it happens to be in the department who should be responsible for this stuff. But whoever it is, it's falling very desperately through the cracks. There was no communication regarding anything to do with Chip Kelly's negotiations. I know that's going on behind the scenes, but with the hard cores of the fan base anyway, because the casual fans really aren't paying attention to when Chip Kelly has a buyout, for example. But for recruits and for hardcore fans, there was really no clarity on it whatsoever at any point. And so, yeah, it really has, it's been striking the level to which UCLA fans and UCLA partners have been left kind of flailing at times where there needed to be clear and direct communication. And so I hope it's something that gets fixed, whoever needs to fix it. But it's been an ongoing problem since the academic year started, quite frankly. So
you said you don't know that it's Jarman or not, but I think if he's the AD, it's ultimately his responsibility.
Everything filters upward. Because he's the one who runs that ship, he's the one who has to kind of own it. But at the same time, if it's underlings of his, whether it happens to be him personally, whoever it is, it needs to get sorted out, and it needs to get sorted out quickly, because it's pissing off UCLA coaches as much as it is UCLA partners. So, and players for that matter. That is something that they need to pay attention to. They need to know that it is an issue, and they need to find solutions. For if it's a person who's failing, that person needs to have their responsibilities reassigned. I know it's a state job, so they're not going to lose it, but they need to have their responsibilities reassigned at the very least. If it's Jarman himself, then it's a Matt. He needs to mature from a young AD to a grizzled AD real quick, not in the Dan Guerrero mold either, like an actual proactive AD. If it's whatever it happens to be. If it's the SID, they need to find a way to get their shop in order, like whatever it happens to be. Whoever is in charge of these communications for moments that could be considered more negative, the messages are not getting through, and they're not getting through in a timely manner. So that just needs to be addressed in terms of process, in terms of kind of workflow, whatever it needs to be.
Fair enough. All right. I hand it over to you and the questions from the listeners.
You mind if I ask you a question first from me?
Totally fine.
How, knowing what we know now about the way that this, basically knowing what we know now, seeing how the season went, kind of seeing how the staff is in flux and the team is in flux, how do you feel about the idea of a Chip Kelly extension, and what are your hopes for the immediate and intermediate future?
Well, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I was always of the mindset that you have to extend a coach. You can't have a coach on a year to year, you know, or basically on the last year of his contract, because you will kill his ability to recruit, you know, however meager that ability and interest and activity actually was. But you make it impossible to retain and attract talent in that situation. And then, so within that, if that was going to happen, I'm hoping that it has happened and been structured in such a way as to make the penalties for moving forward, to make them not prohibitive. And, also for, just to update the assessment of his value to the program to reflect what he has actually done. And, within reason, obviously you can't bust him down to a minimum wage, but, that it reflects the reality of what has been and not just the hopes of what could be the way it was when we first signed him. And then with regard to the actual performance and, what the hopes for him running the program, I'm still torn. Like, I would have been fine if he left. I was hoping he took the Oregon job. I would not have, shed a tear if we decided to let him go at the end of the year. But at the same time, I'm still not convinced that it can't work and that we can't stumble upon some level of success. I don't think obviously it's the surefire bet, the silver bullet that's going to, take us to a new age of glory. But, while there could always be a better option somewhere, I'm not convinced that this doesn't seem the same doomed dead man walking it has been in previous hiring, firing situations with UCLA football coaches for me. And again, a lot of that is still just banking on the fact that I know he has the ability and has shown, has a record in college football of being able to show success. And it's just a question of getting out of his own way. But, and that may never happen. But the fact that it's there gives me, a level of, just kind of contentment is the wrong word. Just somewhere between contentment and resignation. Just it'll be. And it's not a foregone conclusion that this is going to be a disaster.
Do you have any enthusiasm whatsoever?
No, not particularly.
Okay. Let me read off to you next year's schedule, just off, purely off the cuff. And I, like you said, by the way, none of us, we didn't discuss any of this. So this is a genuine in the moment reaction from Nathan. Set the baseline for me for next year. What you think a minimum expectation as far as wins, a reasonable expectation as far as minimum level of wins would be. So we start out the season with Bowling Green, Alabama State, and South Alabama all at home.
Okay.
At Colorado to open up the conference season, then Washington and Utah at the Rose Bowl. So five of our first six games are at the Rose Bowl.
Okay.
Colorado, Washington, Utah to start the conference season. Then a bye week, then at Oregon, fortuitously timed bye week, at Oregon, Stanford at home, at Arizona State, home to Arizona, home to USC, at Cal to wrap things up.
I have us at – so I look at that schedule and just kind of going on gut reaction, I pick us to be probably 9-3, maybe 8-4.
It is the and see, that's the thing. This is the biggest pillow fight of a schedule that mm-hmm. UCLA's had in living memory. And the best that we can expect, or the most reasonable expectation, is in that 9-8-4, 9-3 range. If this was, like, for example, it was that 2013 Jim Mora team. There's no way that we have an expectation below 10-2, and we're staring 11-1 or 12-0 directly in the face.
Mm-hmm.
But because of both the lowered expectations that we've suffered under this coach.
Well, that said, even in that 2013 Jim Mora, we also then, but we would have won, you know, we would have probably beaten perhaps Oregon, but then stumbled against, you know, Arizona.
I don't know about that because you take how talented that team was and you port it over to this Pac-12 right now. They're the most they're lapping the field as far as talent was concerned. Like if you looked at that defense, and I know that you can't do this, but just to get like that defense with Kenny Clark, Eddie Vanderdoest, Tack McKinley, I think was on the squad by that point. Anthony Barr, Cassius Marsh, Miles Jack. Like I'm reading these names, like I'm reciting these names, and it's just like NFL. Miles Jack,
yeah.
Jordan Zumwalt, Eric Hendricks, like.
I don't think
they lose to those kinds of teams. I don't.
You wouldn't think so, but one of the narratives of the Jim Mora era was that that one, we never performed to the level of our talent, and two, we always found a way to come up big and perform well in big games, even if we didn't always win them. But then to lose, you know, a game we shouldn't.
Right? Sure, I completely agree with you.
Focus was never there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This isn't talking about Jim Mora's qualities as a coach. It's just the talent level has dropped off so much. And
so when you said imagine that team. I was thinking if we had had that schedule in that year with him as coach. But you mean imagine that talent playing?
Imagine that talent to get
that
schedule.
Got it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, but I mean, it just with Chip Kelly, it. I just have to get this off my chest, and no one's going to be surprised to know that I think UCLA football is making a huge mistake by extending Chip Kelly. And I mean, it was obvious after 2 years, but 4 years it's been more than enough to ascertain exactly what Chip Kelly is at this stage of his coaching career. And that's a pretty good, not great, but pretty good offensive coordinator.
He's not
a head coach.
Question for you.
Yeah.
When you say you're disappointed that they extended him, is that another way of basically saying you're disappointed they didn't fire him? Or are you saying that even in a world where they, because of, you know, getting spooked by the money or whatever, that even in a world or the market, even in a world where we decided that we weren't going to fire him, that we should not have extended him?
No, we should have fired him. Okay. And people are going to say, oh, well, show me where you're getting the $9 million and you pay the money.
Yeah, whatever. I don't care about that for the purposes of this conversation.
It wasn't my question for $9 million regardless. But
my question for you, though, is am I right, though, that if you're going to keep him, you have to extend him?
Oh, yeah. Yes, you're correct.
Okay.
If you're going to keep him, you have to extend him. But it's the idea of thinking that there is a future with him as head coach at all. Because, I mean – at the end of the day, Chip Kelly has no interest in doing what everyone knows is required of a top-tier college football head coach. He doesn't recruit. He doesn't in any way have a long-term vision for the way that a roster should be managed and mapped out. He doesn't pay attention to all phases of the ball to ensure that competent schemes are being installed on all sides. And none of that is going to change because for his record, when people show you what they are, believe them. And that's what he is at this point. None of that's going to change. And so we had a four-year buildup that led to a season in which the offense was very good against bad teams and mediocre against good teams. And the defense was decent against bad teams and abysmal against good teams, which is, you know, it's basically what we were in his first year, just with younger players and a far tougher schedule back then. So after 4 years,
and half of a roster,
and half of a roster, absolutely. But the fundamentals haven't changed. The offense is decent when it has the opportunity to be, and it's shut down by teams against whom Chip gets too cute and they smack him in the face. And the defense is what it is. It can play well against offenses that are abysmal and against offenses that are remotely competent. It cannot stop them. So after 4 years, he's 18-25 overall with only 2 wins against teams with winning records in 4 years and 0 wins against any team that won 8 or more games in a season. And so based on that schedule that we just saw, this is what's going to happen. He's going to pad his record this year with 9-10 wins because it's essentially impossible to do anything worse against that pillow fight that's in front of him. And then the following year, the non-conference is slightly tougher. We get Coastal Carolina at home, and we get in, which is a decent program at this point. We travel to San Diego State. But the conference schedule eases up when we lose Washington and Oregon for Oregon State and Washington State. And so that's a probably another 8-9 win season. And we're going to be getting fat on empty calories. There's a lot of fans who are going to eat up those empty calories and fill up on them and feel pretty good about it at that point. And a lot of people are going to make the mistake that this is the establishment of a good football program, and recruiting is going to improve even a little bit at that point, because regardless of how little effort the staff under Chip Kelly's direction actually puts into high school recruiting, wins whitewash a lot of sins, and recruits, and for the most part, the and fans and the CFP committee, for the most part, for that matter, don't care about strength of schedule. But unless there's a real hunger to kind of be like, hey, this winning thing feels pretty good, let's try to do more of that. What does that take? Unless that feeling starts to permeate and Chip Kelly gets the itch to be a real head coach rather than a glorified offensive coordinator, and he wants to leverage the good fortune of the scheduling gods and turn it into something sustainable in all facets of the program, then at its core, the football program success is going to just be hollow. At the center of it, and at the center of it is going to be an offensive coordinator who likes the fancier title and the control that comes with it and the salary that comes with it, but has no interest in embracing the full set of responsibilities that come with that power. And if you don't have a true head coach who wants to do the things that a head coach has to do to succeed on the college level, the football program is not going to be sustainably good long term. He's on living on borrowed time, waiting for the scheduling pendulum to swing back the other way at that point. That's all that's happening. And that's all that will be happening over the next 2 years.
I take your point that the risk here is that we inflate his record and make it hard to move on next year or the year after, right? I take that, and I think that that's true. And this is not a yeah, but as in minimizing that. The other thing I am thinking, though, or the other thing I am wondering, though, is do you believe that this extension is given to Chip Kelly with a sincere, good faith belief by the administration that he is going to be the one that take us to that level? Like, is it a vote of confidence? Because I don't see it that way. I see it as we have to give him an extension because we weren't ready to move now. And in order to do, you know, and because we don't want to tank the program to make it less attractive to someone else we bring in, we need to give him the extension so that the bottom just doesn't fall out of recruiting. And so this is what it looks like. And we're just going to bide our time, you know, a year or two until the market and the situation is such that we can, you know, grab an opportunity and move forward with, you know, with something that we think actually will be a positive answer for the future.
I see what you're saying, but yeah. I don't think that if that's your vision, if you're Martin Jarmond, you have to do the thing that I just did, and you have to look at the future, and you have to say to yourself, if my plan is ultimately to make a move when the market is more favorable, am I doing myself a favor in that regard by rehabilitating his image and fattening him up on empty calories with the schedule that's going to be? No UCLA coach is going to get fired after a 9-win season. Hell, after an 8-win season, it's not going to happen. And so what you've done is you've basically, regardless, if you don't think Chip Kelly is the right coach for you, then you just tied yourself in for another 3 years minimum, because Chip Kelly is going to be in our lives for the next 3 years unless he chooses otherwise, at minimum. And so if you're Martin Jarmond and you are just waiting for the right opportunity is not going to come until after 2024 at the earliest, because if you figure 2022 and 2023 are minimum 8-win years based on the schedules, you're going to have to wait till 2024 for a wobble. And because UCLA fans are who they are, and a significant plurality of UCLA fans are part of the cult of the coach, where you conflate being supporters of the program with being supporters of the coach, no one would dare make a move against Chip Kelly after that. So it's going to be, oh, well, his 2022 and 2023 were amazing. You have to give him a chance to rehabilitate himself again. And if he fails in 2025, okay, then you can make a move. But because of the inherent nature of UCLA alumni, the athletic department, fandom, whatever you want to call it, this chance to rehab him is going to earn him fluff years at the end that he doesn't deserve, because they're going to be empty calories. Because he's not a real head coach at the end of the day. He is a glorified offensive coordinator, and I don't care who that pisses off. It is what he is.
So this is where my, you know, what jaded, battered Bruin syndrome, you know, whatever, world weariness comes in, and just that, like, you know, 2 years of 10 wins may be empty calories, but you know, what really are we watching this team for if not to have good, successful years, you know? And in the sense that I understand it is not part of a long-term plan to compete on a national level. And I know, given the conversations we had, you know, in our last or other, you know, episode right before that, I can't remember because they were so long ago. You know, there is a titanic shift in the landscape, or a tectonic shift in the landscape coming in the next decade or so in college football with regard to leagues and alignments and all that stuff. And it can be crucial where we are, you know, whether we have built to be ready for that or not. Right? Conceded. I get it. However, I think that, at least for me, I'm not going to say that it's a mistake. I'm not going to make a normative statement that is applicable to everyone. For me, I am no longer thinking of UCLA football as something that needs to be on some sort of teleological long-term plan for dominance as much as I am. I just want them to be enjoyable again. I just want to win. I want to have it be something that, like, there are fun wins and fun players, and I can teach my kids to follow the team, and, you know, and that we compete and that we beat USC, you know, the pants off USC every damn year. But other than that, like, I guess it's a recalibration of expectations, or a, you know, retrenching in what exactly do I want out of this program? And I don't know that, I guess I'm not so swift to take 10 win seasons and scoff at them as meaningless because they don't fit into some larger, you know, decade long arc of upward mobility.
I don't think winning, I'm not criticizing the idea of winning. What I'm criticizing is the having somebody at the helm who is able to leverage a moderate degree of success and build the foundation, the platform for something more, because the opportunity is there. Yeah, Lincoln Riley's at USC and they're going to dominate. Fine. I'm conceding at that point, even if other people aren't. But I'll frame it this way. If we were going to take a slight regression under a new coach, let's just say we got rid of Chip Kelly and we hired Dan Lanning, the guy who just took over at Oregon, the guy who just basically recreated Jim Mora's staff from like 2012 or whatever it was. But with Tosh Lupoi as the defensive coordinator, basically he hired a staff of recruiters. Like, Oregon is going to recruit. They're going to make the effort that Mario Cristobal's staff put in look like they were lazy, essentially. But they have no scheme chops whatsoever on that staff anywhere. They hired Adrian Clem. They hired Demetrius Martin. Like just to give you an idea, Tosh Lupoi, like basically every famous West Coast recruiter they've hired, essentially. If you took that staff of football bros, essentially, like even to an even more extreme extent than what's going on at Arizona State, and you put them at UCLA this season, and rather than go 10-2 against that pillow fight of a schedule, they went 8-4. Would UCLA be able to bring in a better base of talent that projects better into the future with Chip Kelly's 10-win staff or Dan Lanning's 8-win staff?
Are you asking me as a question?
Yeah, I'm asking as a question.
Oh, I imagine
it's that. A rhetorical question, but yeah. The answer is obvious.
Yes.
The same thing with the next season. Would a Dan Lanning staff be able to recruit better off of a 7-5 season than a Chip Kelly staff would be able to recruit off of a 9-3 or 8-4 season? The answer is unequivocally yes. And at that point, when the schedule turns, say Dan Lanning has a bad year, and you want to put a real head coach in place at that point. He hasn't proven himself to be a real head coach or otherwise yet, but at the very least, I would know that going into 24, 25, and into the future, a base of talent will be, the cupboard will be full, the way that Rick Neuheisel left it after his 3 remarkably unsuccessful seasons. He at least recruited his ass off, and so there was a foundation of talent there for when Jim Mora put adults in place for 3 years. When adults finally fell into place, if Dan Lanning happened to be nothing more than a glorified recruiter, a future coach could leverage that. If Chip Kelly fails, when he fails, because he is a hollow husk of a head football coach, he is a glorified offensive coordinator, when he does fail, the cupboard will be bare, and it will be a full rebuilding job. It won't be, oh, at least the foundation was laid by somebody who put the talent in place, and now the schemes and the adults need to be in the room, so on and so forth. It will be, wow, this is a crater that needs to be refilled. And that's the difference, is that I know that it's looking way too far ahead about something you can't predict. But to me, it's just so eminently predictable. The idea that the next coach UCLA hires is going to need to be a crisis manager rather than a real head football coach, because what Chip Kelly is going to leave behind because he doesn't care about being a head coach is not going to be something viable. And I know that this is in 2025 because he's going to be here forever based on the schedule. But just looking long term, he's not a real head football coach, and nothing is going to make him be at this point. And so any success they have getting, I know I called it empty calories. And I know I called it hollow, but that's what it is to me. I'm not discouraging UCLA from winning football games. What I am saying is that there was a tremendous opportunity missed to build something larger than, hey, a couple of feel good seasons until we kind of revert back to the norm.
Sure. And to clarify, and I think you know this, I'm not saying I think, you know, whatever the wins that come next year means that Chip is a fine answer for our for our future. I'm just saying, if we take as given the decision by the administration and by Martin Jarman not to move forward this year because of the market, right? I dispute that as a good idea. I don't think that it is a good idea to have done that. But given that that is the reality, you know, the fact that giving Chip Kelly the extension is necessary, to me, I see what you're saying about the case about what it does to the program, but all I'm saying is I'm not as convinced that it would be a disaster. You know, that having made this decision to extend him because we didn't want to move forward at this time, like, you know, whatever, it'll be what it'll be, I guess.
I hate that I care this much. I really do.
Yeah.
What can you do?
All right. Next topic.
All right. So now let's jump into the questions. I got Chip Kelly being a hollow husk of a coach off my chest. So anyway, the euphoric purgatory that's to come. Let's see what we got here. I asked our listeners, with so much to cover right now, please let us know what you want us to prioritize on the show by sending us your questions and suggestions. Let's see here. Westwood Bruins asks, defensive coordinator hot board. Also, can you have a 5-minute weekly interview with UCLA fans? Basically suggesting that as a segment.
If he wants to interview UCLA fans and send us in audio, we can put it on.
Yeah, sure. DC hot board. Tracy Pearson posted his on Bruin Report Online. It seems like the names that are getting buzzed from what Tracy's hearing are names that are kind of younger candidates in their mid-30s to mid-40s
more hopeful than I would have expected.
Yeah, upper tier group of five or lower tier power five. So,
are those the people we think Chip is looking at, or are those the people we want?
That's what Tracy had on his hot board
for who he thinks Chip is looking at.
Who he thinks Chip is looking at? Correct.
Wow. Okay.
There's like, he also put Jimmy Lake on his, and apparently Kamari Ramsey, the signee for UCLA, the safety signee, said that he heard buzz at the All-American game that UCLA could be looking at Jimmy Lake. There's always rumors that float around these things. I just don't put stock in the idea that UCLA is going to hire a guy who was recently let go because he laid hands on a player, and that there were stories that emerged that wasn't the first time. And then also that it leaves a bad taste in my mouth that a guy who was an elite recruiter, the moment he became head coach, became more famous for playing golf than he did for recruiting, and it pissed off a lot of Washington fans. So I don't usually like my defensive coordinators and offensive coordinators to be recruiters. Like, to me, it needs to be a pyramid top-down system, the way that recruiting is. Like, your head coach is your ultimate closer. Your coordinators do it during the off season. Like, they split time between recruiting and kind of fine tuning schemes. And then your position coaches are the ones who are just the kind of go getters on the recruiting trail. To me, a defensive coordinator doesn't necessarily need to be a huge recruiter as well. Like, they need to do it more than that, but they also are responsible for 1/3 of what I call the trident of coaching. You have the recruiting, you have the roster management, and you have and roster and culture management, and you have the schemes. And the coordinators are responsible for 1/3 of that. The recruiter, the position coaches are responsible for 1/3 of that. And then the head coach is responsible for kind of the long-term vision. To me, that's the trident of college football staffing. I think coordinators kind of need to be left in, for the most part, for probably 75% of what they do, to their own devices as far as fine-tuning schemes. But Jimmy Lake, the appeal of him to me is that he is a proven stopper of the air raid at a time where UCLA will need to be stopping the air raid on an annual basis. And so I don't think he will get the job at UCLA as defensive coordinator. I don't think he'll even be in the running, but it was interesting to see his name floated at the very least. So, yeah, we'll see. I like the names that were floated out there by Tracy. I hope that he does a good job kind of talking to people in the athletic department about guys who are going to be interviewing and all that kind of stuff. So I think that it's a pretty solid list. And if it's a name that comes off of that list, I think UCLA fans will be reasonably pleased. But at the end of the day, I've also said that I don't, as bad as Jerry Azzanero was, I don't think that he was UCLA's biggest liability as far as the defense being what it is. I think that the concerted effort to not recruit talent in any real vigorous way is as, if not more, responsible for UCLA's defensive woes than Jerry Azzanero was. And the fact that they've had a hollowing out of talent on the defensive end due to the transfer portal this offseason doesn't really help in that regard either. So anyway, that was from our boy at Westwood Bruins.
So getting rid of Azzanero was a necessity.
Oh, it had to happen. They needed to throw a scalp.
It was a minimum. Yeah.
Absolutely. I would never, ever, ever defend that job that Jerry Azzanero has done. I'm just saying that just because, you know me, there are people who don't look big picture at all. And there's me who just gets drowned in the big picture. To me, that big picture, he was a problem. But he was, to me, more of a symptom than the problem.
Yep.
At K Gile asks us, yes, who is going to be the DC? And Templeton Peck follows up and says, and OC and tight end coach and OL coach and whoever else has the left by next Monday. So let's talk about the staff right now. So yeah, we no longer have an offensive coordinator in name because Justin Fry took the offensive line coach at Ohio State. And so we have an OL coach vacancy. It's going to be filled by Tim Drevno, most likely, who was an analyst for our staff this past season, but had his previous stop was at USC as their offensive line coach before he got let go by Clay Helton. He had another stop at USC previously. He was offensive coordinator and offensive line coach at Michigan under Jim Harbaugh when he took the Michigan job. He's also coached at Stanford and for the 49ers. So, I mean, he's a well-traveled head coach. He's a well-traveled offensive line coach, but he's not somebody who's going to inspire the fans in any real way, considering the fact that he was let go by Clay Helton for not being good enough to coach USC's shambolic offensive line. And he's not known in any real way as a recruiter at this point. And that is one of the primary functions of an offensive line coach, to replenish one of the hardest positions on the field to recruit with an ongoing stream of talent. And Justin Fry, for his part, only signed one offensive lineman in this past recruiting class, Sam Yoon. So, that's a little bit worrying to me that Drevno is going to be getting that job, but we'll see at the end of the day. Tight end coach really, and special teams coordinator for that matter, because Derek Sage left to be the offensive coordinator at Nevada. To me, that's tight end coach is where you park a recruiter, essentially, because you have maximum three tight ends on a team. Usually UCLA will have four next year, but I mean, that is a position where you can absolutely park a recruiter and kind of let them skate by as far as coaching is concerned, because as much as you're developing skills, scheme matters as much as the skills for kind of letting a tight end loose. And we've seen that there have been three tight ends at UCLA each year that Chip Kelly's been here, Caleb Wilson, Devin Asiasi, and then Greg Dulcich, who have thrived at the position. So I don't have any doubt that they can make a tight end look good. As far as that's concerned, I want them to hire somebody who is an all-out recruiter who kind of wears a t-shirt and shorts and a whistle on the practice field. Like, it can be just a dude as a coach, but get somebody who recruits his ass off. I don't think they will, because that's not what Chip Kelly does, but I think that there is a lot of potential there to potentially hire somebody who is a top-notch recruiter. We'll see if they do it. And then UCLA has merged tight end and special teams into one role. Defensive coordinator, we talked about. We replaced Johnny Nansen as defensive line coach with, I'm not going to say his name, Chad Kay. I'm just going to roll with that. do you know this guy's name? Have you seen him?
Is it Polynesian?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I can usually, by the way, I can usually say the Polynesian names. This one is just, it happens to be unique enough. You want me to do it?
No, I'll try it. Help me look it up. How to spell it? Kauha'aha'a.
Kauha'aha'a. Chad K.
Yep.
Anyway, Chad K has been hired as our defensive line coach, has experience coaching at USC and Wisconsin, was most recently at UNLV. And then they hired Ika Ika Maloe as their outside linebackers coach to replace Jason Kafusi. And so, yeah, the staff is in a complete state of flux right now. More than half of the on-field staff is going to be replaced as of next season. And so, yeah, to answer those questions, I don't know who's going to be the DC. It just seems like there's a certain profile they're looking for. They're looking for somebody who runs a 3-3-5 or a 4-2-5 defense and is a bit of a young and up-and-comer, unless it's Jimmy Lake, in which case that's not the case. So,
did I miss this? Is Norwood gone?
No, Norwood's not gone. He's being rumored for the Hawaii head coaching vacancy that was left by Todd Graham after he resigned with pressure from the state Senate.
Yeah, which is awesome. Figure.
Yeah, you have to really be screwing up at that point.
Yeah, I mean, besides, who among us is shocked that Todd Graham is a bad, you know, is a unliked dude?
We knew that there were problems there when Todd Graham's own kid transferred out of Hawaii before his dad left. So anyway.
But anyway, so I was just thinking because I thought we had the impression that at least for the last two seasons that Norwood was in a kind of like potentially, you know, quasi and or secret defensive coordinator role. Mm-hmm. And so he would not be.
It's always been presumed that if the scheme went, if the scheme looked good, that Norwood was eventually being groomed to be elevated. But right since now,
the scheme didn't work out. Okay.
And then there was a little bit of buzz for a while that if since Azanero wasn't immediately canned after the season, that the plan was for either Azanero to come back. There was really no movement on that front for a very long time.
Yeah.
Azanero was in as much of a state of purgatory as Chip Kelly was. But the plan was for either for Azanero to come back or for Norwood to be elevated to replace him, in which case you wouldn't really have any buzz out there. And so, yeah, there was really no movement on the defensive coordinator front for a while. And I think as much as I implicitly or explicitly criticized Martin Jarman earlier for various things, I think you can put down the fact that Azanero is not going to be at UCLA. You can put that down to the fact that as part of the extension of Chip Kelly, he wrested a little bit of staff control away from Chip.
Yeah. The fact that Chip, it happened right before he signed after a period of inactivity in both the defensive coordinator position as well as in whether or not the signing of the extension tells me that those things were linked.
They were linked to each other, and that that was probably the biggest reason why Chip took as long to sign the extension on the table as he did. It really wasn't down to money because he likes the idea of being well paid and the prestige that comes with it. They mentioned this on the broadcast. It is true. Not that they need me to confirm it, but it is true. But he likes the number that's next to his name because it makes him kind of feel important, you know, ego stroking kind of a thing. But beyond that, he likes the idea. He was promised full control of the program. And the
we were promised the blur, damn it.
Yeah, we were never promised the blur, but we were promised success at the very least, and we haven't had it. And so he was promised control, and he was given control by Gene Block. And so having to come to terms with the idea that, and he had it. He had carte blanche for 4 years. So UCLA is not going to be hiring his staff going forward necessarily. But he's not going to have the full carte blanche either if what he wants to do is not fully convincing as far as the long-term viability and the impact on success. So he had to come to terms with the idea that he was not going to have that full control if he wanted to stay at UCLA before he signed his contract. And that was his extension. And that was probably the biggest hangup that he had. And allowing Azanero to retire officially was the sign that concessions were being made on his end that, yeah, you're going to get to stay. You're going to get to keep that head coach title that you love so much and the salary that comes with it, but you're not going to get to do things the same old way because the same old way hasn't produced the results. So, that's,
it just seems kind of rich to me.
Yeah.
You would be upset about that. Like, it's like, yeah, you were promised control, but look what you did with it. Right. You have at the very most, you're at the most generous end of the analysis or grading scale been underwhelming. And so like, if we want to, if we want to change the terms, which is again why you do a different deal, then why, what are you so upset about? Like, you have to have seen this coming.
Yeah, but there's an ego at play here.
Yeah, coaches are arrogant and are bad at self-assessment.
Especially one in particular.
No, many that we've had at UCLA. It's
just a sure, occurrence. But
in the current situation, yes.
He is not a rampant, diabolical douche necessarily, but he thinks very, 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 very highly of himself. And so the idea that anything would reflect him not being this almighty and all-conquering head coach was a hard thing and a hard pill for him to swallow. He had to come to terms with it, but there was some personal reckoning in there that had to happen. And so that leaves us with our final question from at 49 Road King. Have you heard of him?
I have.
From Jim Everhart, father of Nathan. He asks us, and this is our best question in my mind. I think it's a great question. And it's one where I do want your opinion in particular, because I don't know if you two have had this discussion amongst yourselves, but I want, if you have, please tell me. But he asks, transfer portal, good or bad? ?
On a philosophical level or on a, you know, tactical.
He doesn't clarify. So run with it however you see fit.
Well, on a philosophical level, I think good or bad is a moot question, because it is just a necessary recognition of the reality of the modern game. And fighting against that or railing against that is, you know, at best counterproductive. Or refusing to use it out of principle or something for that reason. Yep. In terms of strategic or tactical value, I have always been very wary of programs that are built around transfers, JUCO transfers and grad transfers, right? Like, to me, that is a dangerous ride to get on, because it's hard to get off. It's like a drug, right? It may solve some immediate problems. It may feel great to, you know, bring in a already prepared player through an easy, you know, an easier channel than the normal recruiting process. But it's a hard habit to kick. And so, you know, your program can get to where it becomes dependent on these, and it's hard to manage your roster without having to rely almost solely on this kind of stuff. And that, I have, my understanding is that has led to a lot of, where it has happened. Now, this is before the portal, you know, has made it to where, you know, players are transferring, you know, not necessarily JUCO or grad transfer, but, you know, just after a year because the situation didn't work out. So maybe it works out differently this way. But generally, I've heard that it's a dangerous course or identity for a program to adopt.
I wonder who could be. Who could be prescribed this advice right now?
Well, Chip Kelly.
Yeah.
it's his, like, not get out of jail, but it's his, like, I don't have to recruit, I can do this.
Yep. Exactly. It is I don't know, what do you want to call it? It's ibuprofen, it's penicillin, whatever, for the lazy recruiter. Like, no, that's a bad analogy. Let me see here, because it's not solving anything necessarily. It is a drug for the lazy recruiter, no doubt about it. It is a very, it's a simplistic way to think that you're adding talent, reinforcing a roster with talent, because you don't want to put in the effort to do it the hard way. It's the easy way. It's the way to cut corners for the lazy coach. That's what I've been trying to say this whole time.
Yeah.
And so, good on a moral level, good on a philosophical level, as far as players finally getting this, the ability to have the same level of movement that coaches have been afforded forever. I think that programs that use the transfer portal right are using it to band-aid over a crack or two in their roster while they develop longer-term solutions behind those transfers.
Or just as a, you know, kind of jump at an opportunity. It'd be nice to have this extra player. Like, this is kind of cool, you know, but it's almost one of those things where it's like you know, they say having a drink is fine as long as you don't need the drink. Mm-hmm. The moment the drink starts to serve a utilitarian purpose is when you have to start saying, what am I, you know, am I drinking this because it's fun and it's cool, or am I drinking this because I need it and that's a problem? And that's, I kind of think, how transfer portal works.
You don't want to be addicted to it. You don't want to have to need your fix. It's exactly what you said. It's, if you have the chance to use it to get unequivocally better with an opportunity with a player who presents himself who you wouldn't have had a chance at otherwise, or is coming back around to you now or something along those lines, great, go ahead, use it. But the moment it starts to become a crutch rather than a tool, that's when it becomes a bad thing for a football program. For players, yeah, it indulges some instincts as far as the grass being greener on the other side the moment there's a whenever a moment of frustration may strike. But you are dealing with teenagers and young adults. At the end of the day, you have to bake that into the cake regardless of whether there's a transfer portal or not. You have to bake a certain level of immaturity in regardless. So I don't think that just because there's a transfer portal that allows some players to act out in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise means necessarily that everything is, the entire system is on fire necessarily. It is kind of the Wild West of the transfer portal right now. As the system matures and people see success rates out of the transfer portal, the not just the need, but I guess how to take advantage of a new opportunity using the transfer portal, we're going to see whether the level of player movement subsides, whether it increases, whether it stabilizes. These things are still to be determined. It is a system that's yet to mature. But at the very least, one thing we know is that for the programs that are not cutting corners, they use the transfer portal as a tool and not as a crutch. If you're a new coach like a Mel Tucker or Lincoln Riley, you hit it hard to paper over cracks on a roster that's been neglected, and you use it to try to jumpstart things to have a modicum of immediate success. But your long-term plan is always the traditional college football roster building model. For the coaches who want to cut corners, though, and kind of just want their little hit of recruiting to get who they want in immediately and not have to put in the work with the players who are going to be that, who could make up the long-term foundation of something bigger picture, those are the coaches who are going to come to rely on the transfer portal, and they're going to need their fix, and there are going to be years where an unsteady supply doesn't give you the things you need, and your roster is going to suffer for it as a result. And you just have a massive amount of turnover where you do not know what to expect from your roster year to year, which makes a long-term planning project impossible.
And that's the thing I was going to say. It makes it another, you know, for Chip, makes it a particularly dangerous thing is, you know, given the, you know, the weird, you know, fluctuation we've had in, you know, linebacker classes, and, you know, that bringing in 10 linebackers and then no linebackers and whatever, right? The idea of roster management in terms of balancing classes so that you have a steady flow of players, of a certain level of experience every year, of quality and experience every year, has already proven to be something that Chip Kelly is, you know, not good at or uninterested in. And I feel like relying on the transfer portal makes that extra important. Right. Like that's it makes it doubly hard because if on average, if you're only getting players for half the time, you've got to keep doing that. And you've got to keep monitoring, well, who's in what class, you know, what do we have, you know, on these kind of, you know, these classes. And it takes something he's already bad at and makes it even harder.
Yep, exactly. Bad by choice as much as by nature.
Sure. So just he has done a bad job at.
Because he is an offensive coordinator with the head coach title. Anyway, on that happy note, to tie off that loose end, on that happy note, those are the questions that we have for this week, and I think that's a decent return to the swing of things.
All right. Well, thanks, y'all. Why don't we, you know, plan to touch base? Let's see. Next Tuesday is the Arizona game.
Next Tuesday is the Arizona game. So let's. Right, we look at Wednesday or Thursday, maybe.
I was gonna say we might do Wednesday or Thursday, or we might kick it to the following week. So just to give you a heads up, if you don't hear from us next week, that's why. And we can use that as an opportunity to talk about that game and also just to kind of do a, you know, mid-season check-in on basketball. Yeah, that sounds good. But until then, go Bruins.
Go Bruins.
Kau, right? K-A-U? Kau ha ha. Kau ha ha.
Kau ha ha. Chad K.